Hi, it's Gary. Just a heads up, the opening segment of this episode deals with mature topics. You will not, for instance, want to listen in the car or on in-home speakers if there is a small child within earshot. So with that out of the way, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling.
I'm Jenny Brentis.
I'm Connor Rohr.
And we are through Sunday of Week 17 here, the penultimate week of the regular season. Lots of exciting games, lots of big finishes, lots of playoff implications, but it was also a really strange week, and we are starting off this show with a discussion of certainly the strangest development that we saw on Sunday, or really have seen in quite a while, and that was Antonio Brown in the third quarter of the Buccaneers game in East Rutherford against the Jets, removing his jersey and his shell, removing his undershirt, and just walking off the field in the middle of the game, apparently caught a ride home. Bruce Arians said afterwards he is no longer a member of the Buccaneers, and that's where we are with it.
Yeah, and it was certainly a bizarre situation, Gary, and we don't know all of the specifics. Bruce Arians didn't elaborate on very many of the specifics after the game, but I do think we should back up for a second and consider all of the history that got us to this point. I mean, earlier this season, of course, he lied about his vaccination status, was suspended for 3 games, and then welcomed back by the Bucks. But before that, the things that Sports Illustrated wrote about in 2019, there was a civil suit by a former trainer alleging rape that was later settled out of court. But there was also an allegation of sexual misconduct by an artist that he worked with. After Sports Illustrated wrote about this, he then threatened the artist via text message, her and her children. And there were a number of other, you know, allegations and incidents over a period of several years. So while this one isolated incident, we don't have all of the information about what happened, we do have a pattern of behavior. And I think what's notable is that the Buccaneers knew all of that when they took him on, and they continued to make excuses for him, didn't answer questions, kind of glossed over things. You know, I directly asked Jason Light before the Super Bowl last year about why they felt comfortable bringing Brown in, knowing all of these things. And he said they had done their due diligence, but declined to provide specifics about what that actually entailed. But the thing that gets them to part ways is something on the football field. And I think that's the problem, right? That no matter what Bruce Arians or any other members of the organization say about the growth that they've seen and, you know, what Tom Brady says he's, you know, taking Brown under his wings, Brown keeps getting more chances because he can help the team win on the field. Last season, he helped the Buccaneers win a Super Bowl championship. And once he was more harmful than helpful on the field, the team parted ways. I think that showed that there were a lot of empty words spoken by the Buccaneers organization, and also more broadly that how the NFL handles misconduct is broken.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point, Jenny, and I think that a lot of these coaches, they fall back on this idea, and maybe it goes back to experiences that they've had with coaches and their own coaches in the past or whatever it is, that football can fix problems, or that football can take somebody in and assimilate them into a culture and then send them back out into society as a different person. And I think that even if the motives for bringing Antonio Brown in were good, which I can't imagine that they necessarily were. I mean, Tom Brady let Antonio Brown live in his house. He set him up with Tony Robbins, who is known, I guess, for helping people develop more of a positive mindset. Even if the motives were purely to take this player who was at one point in his career headed for the Hall of Fame and put him back on the right track, then you can't, to your point, Jenny, just, you know, it rings so shallow then to cut him now, right? Like, I mean, you stood by him during a felony. You stood by him knowing that there was, you know, a civil allegation of forcible rape. And so now all of a sudden that, you know, you're talking about becoming a better human and all this other stuff, and then he does something on the field that, you know, Tom Brady said after the game, you know, that Antonio needed help. He seemed concerned. Le'Veon Bell said the first thing he did when he got into the locker room was reach out to Antonio Brown and make sure he was okay. So now where does he, like, you, now you just cut him. And I think that just feel like the whole thing just feels strange. I'm not defending Antonio Brown here. You know, I'm not saying that the, you know, any of his past transgressions are excusable in any way, shape or form, but you know, teams in general can't have it both ways. Like, you can't say that football reclaims lives and that we're makers of men, and then when at the first sight of a personally embarrassing situation, like, yeah, Bruce Arians was personally embarrassed, then you're going to cut him. Just a week ago, he was telling NBC that he had enjoyed watching this process of Antonio Brown maturing and, you know, Antonio Brown becoming a better person. And, you know, if you're going to go that route, you have to understand that any growth and any, whatever you want to call it, recovery, you know, whatever it is not this linear ascension. And there's going to be these weird bumps in the road. And, you know, if you're really interested in rehabilitating the person, then it, you know, then to cut him and then say, I'm not talking about him anymore is sort of a weird thing. When a week ago, you literally just said, oh, I enjoyed watching this whole process of him becoming a better person.
Yeah, the Bucs whole handling of this just step after step just seemed to be less defensible as we go along, and now we arrive at this point. But again, the thing that always got to me about this was, you know, there has to be a path back for these guys who do terrible things, you know, off the field or on the field. Some of those paths have to be longer than others. Antonio Brown never showed any contrition for specifically the mistreatment of women. I mean, he was on ESPN after getting released by the Patriots talking about how he felt he had never had any problem with women, this was all, you know, basically people making stuff up about him, and that's the way it is, even though, you know, aside from our independent reporting, you could look at police reports, you could look at Antonio Brown's social media feed, and see him just abhorrent treatment of women. So the Bucs did not make him clear that huddle before he joined the organization. They said they were, you know, they were seeing progress. They were never specific about what progress it was. They don't need to be, but you could see, at least from a public-facing standpoint, you know, go back to the vaccine card. Antonio Brown, the day before he was suspended, was on Richard Sherman's podcast, and the two of them had a conversation about how Antonio Brown was actually the victim here. This was a media narrative about his fake vaccine card, but he's actually vaccinated, and this is just, you know, this is just people out to get him, just making things up about him. And then, you know, a day later, he's suspended for an offense that he did not appeal. So there was no consequence from the team at any point for any of this behavior. And it just really created an atmosphere where it didn't really seem like they particularly cared what he was going to do, as long as it was not coming into the locker room, which is a pretty, just, you know, whatever. It's, we're not going to pretend every player in every locker room is a saint, but you know, you have to be able to function in society, and it just seemed like they didn't really care how he was outside of their locker room and off the field. And again, the other thing I just mentioned, these are not heat-of-the-moment mistakes that Antonio Brown was making. Today might have been, but the, you know, if you go back to his sexual misconduct, if you go back to the fake vaccination card, these are, you know, these are kind of premeditated actions that he's then not being truthful about in a public setting. He's claiming that he's a victim. It's just not, it's not something that can be condoned, and the Bucs just kind of seem fine going along with it. And when Bruce Arians was questioned about it, and Bruce Arians is the, you know, along with Tom Brady, the front-facing person in this organization, you know, 2 weeks ago, he profanely and sophomorically dismissed, you know, any criticism of how he was handling Antonio Brown. He said he didn't give a S word. I don't know why I'm holding back a swear during this conversation, but I am. And, you know, Bruce Arians holds himself up as someone who advocates for women in coaching. He advocates for black head coaches. If anyone ever, you know, had some sort of, if he had criticism of someone in those arenas and they told him that they don't care about it, you know, that would be that would be incredibly problematic if a powerful person said something about those things.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem in when you bring a player back solely based on their ability to help the team win. When you give second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth chances solely based on their football ability, it creates a situation that we've seen with Brown where that behavior is then enabled and there's never a correction. We're not saying that people don't deserve chances, and I think you laid that out very well, Gary, but when those chances don't come about with a plan for addressing behavior, when they don't come after the organization has gotten all of the information they can get about what led to specific behaviors and misbehaviors, then you have an issue. And remember, this is the same organization that when they drafted Jameis Winston, number one overall, didn't make an effort to contact the woman that said Winston had raped her at Florida State. So I think, you know, you see a problem with vetting. You see a problem with taking seriously the idea that if you're giving somebody a second chance, they have work to do beyond winning the trust of their teammates, beyond what's done in the locker room setting. And that's why the history of Brown's behavior is important to this conversation, because like we said, we don't have all of the information today, but there's a long pattern of behavior. There's a long history of teams being willing to give him additional chances because of his talent on the field. And that creates bad behaviors layered upon each other without the necessary correction.
All right, so the Bucs won this game, 28-24, by the way, a comeback win without Brown on the field during the fourth quarter. After the break here, we have plenty of football to get to. Lots of exciting stuff, big win for the Bengals, upset win for the Cardinals, and we'll get to it in just a second here.
Vikings, Packers.
All right, so the Sunday night game, a little bit anticlimactic. No Kirk Cousins because of COVID protocols. Sean Mannion gets to start for the Vikings in very cold weather. I should say Sean Mannion, leading rusher for the Vikings on this night. 14 yards on 2 carries, beats out Dalvin Cook's 13 yards on 9 carries. And that's about all you really have to know about this one. The Vikings were kind of outclassed, and just kind of an easy win for the Packers. I think the concern for the Packers has been what happens on the defense side of the ball, but this was not really a night to be tested.
Yeah, it knocks the Vikings out of the playoffs. I think, what is that, the fifth time now in 8 seasons that a Mike Zimmer team hasn't reached the postseason? You know, he was on that streak of every other year for a little while, but yeah, these are not good times. Doesn't necessarily seem like there's an easy way out of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably... We don't expect there to be a ton of head coach openings this year, but the Vikings could be one potential dark horse in the mix. But for the Packers, seal up home field advantage in the playoffs, and the conditions that they played in Sunday night will likely be the conditions that our NFC teams are forced to play in for the duration of the playoffs. And I mean, I think the big question will come at the end of the season for Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. I mean, yet another successful regular season. They got the Matt LaFleur hire right. And here they are, the number one seed again. We'll have a good chance to make it to the Super Bowl. But how does the season end? And then what happens from here with Packers and Rodgers?
Sort of weird that the very system that Rodgers spent the entire offseason rebelling against has built one hell of a football team. Like, you know, the Packers are really good, you know, and some of their best players, like Devondre Campbell, is making nothing this year. Like, they found that guy in the middle of nowhere, and is outside of Micah Parsons, like, the best linebacker in football this season. And
Rasul Douglas?
Yeah, I mean, like, they're so... So many good players that, like, aren't Randall Cobb that, you know, he shouldn't be super mad about. But, you know, it is weird that maybe he forced some change on the inside. Maybe they're nicer to everybody. I don't know. But it is kind of funny how it all works out.
Once you get Randall Cobb, the floodgates just open. I will say, in a way, it has to be a little bit miserable to be a Packers fan because you're 13-3 again. One more game to go, but whatever. But none of this really matters because you're just going to have to wait till the NFC title game to see if this season is going to be enjoyable in retrospect or not.
Chiefs, Bengals.
All right, guys, the Bengals are AFC North champions, and they do it in just a, I don't know, this is just a really cool signature win here for the Bengals. I hope Bengals fans are thrilled by this. This is a game they trailed by 2 touchdowns in the first half. They trailed by 11 at halftime, but they come back and win it behind just another monster performance by Joe Burrow, and Ja'Marr Chase was absolutely not only unguardable, but kind of couldn't be tackled in this game.
Yeah, at what point were they going to double-team him? I was just curious. Like, at what point do you make it your defensive focus to sort of take him out of the game? I mean, I know that there were some times where the coverage was rolled towards him, but I didn't see a lot of times where, like, it was impossible for him to get the ball. Not taking credit away from, I mean, Joe Burrow is doing it in a very extraordinary fashion. But, like, you know, if it's a game like this with a lot on the line, you know, I feel like you could probably lock down one guy, you know?
you could probably tackle Ja'Marr Chase at some point if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, if the game is tied, the Bengals have the ball, 3rd and 27, why don't you have more than one player on Ja'Marr Chase? It seemed like there was just not the best effort to disrupt the pass that was inevitably going to go to Ja'Marr Chase.
I will say T. Higgins is very good as well. But Ja'Marr Chase, basically every time he was in single coverage, it was just like, it was automatic. And there was, I feel like there was one play, it was Charvarius Ward broke up a pass in the second quarter and did the, you know, did the gritty in celebration, sort of rubbing it in a little bit against Ja'Marr Chase. And it just sort of struck me like, I don't know if I'd do that. Because it feels like you're going to regret that at some point. Maybe not this game. Maybe down the line at some point. But no, you just regretted it later that game. He actually gave a touchdown to Ja'Marr Chase like 3 plays later. But it's an offense that it's a lot of spread stuff. It's a lot of stuff out of empty. It's a lot to put on the plate of a second-year quarterback. And Joe Burrow is just, he's just kind of doing it all. And he's doing it all behind an offensive line that isn't very good on the interior. It's just really, really impressive at this point.
Yeah, I'm still amazed, like, you know, just looking back at a few of the plays from this game, his pocket mobility, his comfort, his presence. I mean, you know, the Chiefs did try to bring pressure in this game, and I think that that's been the general idea over the prevailing idea over the last few weeks. We've seen it with the Ravens, where, you know, it was just, if you can get him off rhythm, if you can force him to kind of pinball around in the pocket, he's going to make these errors. But he's so comfortable for a player that, like, has no reason to be comfortable. This still really isn't a good offensive line. And last year, he almost had a career-altering knee injury. And I think, like, I know I say this every week, but you just go back and you marvel at the fact that he had to get over some pretty significant stuff. I mean, it wasn't that long ago in training camp that we were talking about him being legitimately and understandably hesitant when offensive linemen were, like, falling at his ankles during passing drills.
Yeah, he has this remarkable confidence to, you know, play behind a line that hasn't been perfect, obviously, to throw the ball up to Ja'Marr Chase and think he's going to come down with it, to lead a team like the Bengals back to the playoffs. You know, when Baker Mayfield was drafted by the Browns, and, you know, we're going to get to some of this a little bit later, I think, but, you know, the whole thing was, oh, he has the mentality that can change the organization. But the same is very much true for Joe Burrow. He has that kind of confidence, that cockiness, like, I can go in and turn an organization that is really in need of a leader like me, and I can be that guy. And here they are, AFC North champions.
Any concern from either of you guys that a post-game cigar, do we think this affects you know, his long-term lung capacity? Are we worried about the playoffs and the cigar? Is that a concern for anybody moving forward?
Was it even lit?
Was it lit? My number one question.
Wondered if it was maybe like an accessory.
He had an indoor lit cigar after the LSU championship. I was wondering if, like, wouldn't the stadium, like the all the fire alarms in the stadium, like go off if you had a cigar in the Bengals locker room? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Maybe they'd think ahead and disable them. Maybe it's a well-prepared, not only That's a well-prepared true. Team, but a well-prepared maintenance staff they have there in Cincinnati.
Probably more concerning is the fact that he tweaked his knee a little bit.
Yes.
And it didn't matter because he could end the game. And I think he said afterward that he could have gone back in if necessary. But, you know, he was really limping around on the sideline there.
He lost his nameplate at some point, so it looked like he was, it looked like he, I don't know, it just looked like he got his jersey at Marshall's or something and was just running around out there, just some dude. It was a really cool performance. I want to ask you guys about the final series for the Bengals there, because it was getting a little bit hairy, and I admit I'm a coward. I would have just kicked the field goal there. The situation was fourth and inches at the goal line. Less than a minute left, the Chiefs were out of timeout. So the question is, do we want to score our touchdown and make Patrick Mahomes go the length of the field, or do we just get the field goal and then Patrick Mahomes still has to go, whatever it would end up being, you know, 40 yards or whatever it might be, but they can tie it with a field goal. And Zach Taylor originally, twice, opted to go for the touchdown.
I loved every minute of this, and Zach Taylor on the sidelines sort of reminded me of, so this is the analogy that I've crafted in my head, so see if you can follow me here. An anxious parent that's going like cliff diving, and the kids make fun of the parent for being scared to jump off of the cliff into the water. And the parent's like, no, I'm going to do it. Like, I'm going to prove to you guys that I'm not scared. I'm going to be the cool parent and I'm going to do it. And then he keeps like, you know, and they're like, dad, mom, like, you really don't have to do this. Like, everyone's like, it's fine. Like, and Zach Taylor was like, I want everyone to know how aggressive I am. Like, I'm like John Harbaugh too. And everyone's like, listen, you don't have to be John Harbaugh. Just kick the field goal. Everyone's going to understand this franchise has been so out of sorts for so long. Just kick the field goal. And he was just like, no, I'm not going to kick the field goal. I am cool, Zach Taylor.
Zach, you swept the Ravens already.
You don't have anything to prove.
No, it was because he did it, just in case anyone missed it. They went for it, and then they had offsetting penalties. Maybe they got in, maybe they didn't. Joe Mixon was kind of just reaching over the goal line. They ruled it short, but upon review, he was probably in. But offsetting penalties, so they went back and did it again. And I guess you're Zach Taylor, your mentality is, well, I did it that other time. Why would I not just do the same thing right now?
Maybe that was part of the plan, though, you know? They're going to have some penalties, be able to burn some extra time off the clock. I mean, it worked out perfectly.
It really was perfect. Getting the defensive holding in the end zone on the next play was absolutely like, because then they took the knee, then they clocked it. I was a little bit nervous that Brandon Allen might pull a Kirk Cousins and forget he was supposed to clock it and might take a knee and run out the clock and then we go overtime. That would have been fun. But it was wild. And I hate that. I hate those shotgun formations on fourth and inches. No good. Stop that, everyone.
So you have to do two things. First off, when Joe Mixon almost scored, I had never seen an official before like go up and yell at the player that you didn't score. Like Joe Mixon was like, I scored, and the ref I saw him running up and going, no, you didn't, give me the ball. And Joe Mixon's like, I'm not giving you the ball. And he's like, you didn't score, give me the ball. But speaking of the shotgun thing, the one thing we do have to mention is another cool little Andy Reid, Eric Bieniemy wrinkle there in that game. Did you see on the fourth and short where they had the full house shotgun backfield, but then motioned Travis Kelce under center and then had him sort of try to push his way for the first down? Maybe that's a thing that you borrow in the future. That's a fun little.
Although, as you know, who I think that was Blake Bell. I think that was
That's right. It wasn't Travis Kelce. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
I can't remember what his nickname
was. Your X Factor.
Some Oklahoma fan is gonna have to tell us what Blake Bell's nickname was when he was the big like Tebow quarterback at Oklahoma back in the day. The Belldozer, I think. Maybe I just made that up. Maybe I just gave him a nickname. Anyways, the Chiefs lose for the first time in a long time. They also lost two linemen in this game. Lucas Niang and Orlando Brown Jr. both went down. They end up moving Joe Tooney out to left tackle. So they held up kind of okay for this one, but I don't know if Chiefs fans have any real appetite to test the depth of this offensive line in the postseason for a second straight year.
Cardinals Cowboys.
So the Cardinals finally get back on track and they knock off the Cowboys in Dallas 25-22. A Cowboys team that just put up, I don't, what was it, 112 points last week against Washington. So this was some opportunistic offense from Arizona. They also got a very impressive fake punt conversion at some point, but I thought it was the defense that got it done. I thought they did a really nice job not only shutting down the run, but you know, since the Cowboys were playing from behind, they were throwing it around a lot, and it was just a lot of variety of zone coverages that really Dak Prescott just never really found his rhythm in this one.
Yeah, I think the Cardinals really needed this game to get back on track, and I think you're exactly right, Gary, that the performance of the defense was probably the most encouraging as they head into the postseason, that they could stop a team like the Cowboys. I mean, yes, their offense has had ups and downs this season, but it was a big challenge for the Cardinals' defense, and they were definitely up to it.
Yeah, Vance Joseph is so, you know, traditionally aggressive on those early downs, and then it kind of came back to bite them. But this was an interesting one where it seemed like a lot of the pressures that he was running in the past, like you would drop those guys and all of a sudden you would drop those linebackers. And, you know, it was even from the first drive, it looked like they had just had a read on what Dallas was doing. They had cornerbacks that maybe, while they weren't picking balls off on the first drive, were like almost there. They were almost reading passes. And, you know, that's kind of one of those like ominous signs where you're like, okay, the defense kind of has a beat on what's going on here. I think they're going to have a pretty good game. And it continued. And I think that there is a little bit of sputtering right now going on in Dallas offensively too.
Yeah, such an encouraging performance last week, just because they had been a little bit rocky, especially in the passing game for a while. But this was not a great sign heading into late January / February for Dallas here, and we'll see how they recover. If you didn't see the Jonathan Ward catch on the fake punt, by the way, don't watch it now, but just like write down on a post-it to go look that up on social media later and check it out. It was he did the helmet catch, but it was an opponent's helmet.
And the referee didn't even have to not call in the grasp for it to happen. Even better.
And the Cowboys did rally back from an early deficit. They had a chance to win this game, and there was that play at the very end where Chase Edmonds maybe fumbled, maybe didn't. The replays were kind of inconclusive. It was not ruled a fumble on the field, so you would have needed incontrovertible video evidence, but it didn't matter because the Cowboys didn't have any timeouts left, so they couldn't challenge it. And it was kind of one of those situations where maybe it would have swung the other way. It has prompted, of course, a dialogue about Mike McCarthy's time management, and it might not have made a difference in the game, but if you're a Cowboys fan or a member of the organization, it was a frustrating, could have been situation.
Yeah, we'll call it inconclusive, and by that I mean if you're a fan of either team and are all fired up about it, we agree with you, no matter who you are.
Great. But, staying on the right side of the Cardinals fan base is always a good plan, Gary.
And the Cowboys fan base, if that's the case. But everyone's right. Yeah, I don't know. It was if his knee was off the ground, it was so close. It was like millimeters.
Yeah.
And it was just, I don't know. It was probably one of those, whatever way it was called in the field, they were going to have to stick with it. So that's the way it goes.
Rams, Ravens.
So Lamar Jackson did not make it back for this one. Tyler Huntley back under center for the Ravens. And look, the Ravens are a team everyone's looking at right now and just saying like, okay, well, this should be a win for us. This one was really dicey, though, for the Rams, who trailed for most of this game. They end up getting the late drive to go ahead and take the lead. But boy, it was getting hairy there for them. And Matthew Stafford, we've seen it a couple times this year. He threw another ball where a safety just absolutely read him like a book down near his own goal line, picked it off, and it was a pick six.
Yeah. You know, I guess one thing you can say about Matthew Stafford is when he makes those mistakes and the team is in a hole, he has the ability to dig them out of the hole, which he did do in the second half. So some kudos are in order for doing that. But these maddening plays that have come up, I think that was his fourth pick six of the season, which is the most in the league. So it's an interesting quandary for the Rams because you have this quarterback that you've traded a ton for that has all of this talent who sometimes has these brain farts. And I texted you midway through the game, Gary, wondering if the spreadsheet we have heard in past podcast episodes and in Gary's weekly column about the all-knowing spreadsheet that takes into account all of these factors and evens out luck and tells you who is actually good. And I was very curious if the spreadsheet had figured out what to do with the Rams and Matthew Stafford.
The spreadsheet doesn't quite have all the answers when it comes to these Matthew Stafford interceptions. It has generally ranked, I think I told you this, it's had the Rams hovering somewhere between like 7 and 12 all season here, which is probably about right, and there's probably room to grow here. They went through that sort of rocky period after Robert Woods went down and Odell Beckham Jr. was joining the team and Von Miller was joining up, and so I don't know. There's still, the Rams are still not as good as you want them to be, but they're 12-4 and they're sort of through what seems like is you know, what will end up being the rockiest patch of the season.
Do we think that some of the reason that Matthew Stafford throws these pick sixes is because, you know, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing necessarily, but Sean McVay has not necessarily deviated from play calls that have been successful during the season, if that makes sense. And like, I think he's even addressed it at certain times, like, you will call the same play a lot during a game or in certain situations because it just keeps working and nobody stops it. And do we think it's an example of teams like slowly kind of just picking these things off one by one, week by week, and going into a week and saying, okay, they've done this like 10 times in a row now, and Sean McVay is just sitting there saying, like, if nobody stops it, I'm not going to stop doing it. And then if you pick it off, then okay, I'll just do something else and outscore you anyway.
It's really interesting what's going on with this. I don't have an answer, and that's why I started that answer with it's really interesting. I get the sense sometimes that safeties are starting to jump a little bit on Stafford because they know he's not really going to hesitate in any way, shape, or form. Like, he's not a guy. It's like, you know, Aaron Rodgers is a guy who will, like, if he senses anything resembling any sort of trap out there, he avoids it. Whereas Matthew Stafford is just kind of trusting that, you know, it's gonna be fine. I'm gonna fire it in there at 120 miles an hour, and even if someone's there, it's gonna just, I don't know, disintegrate their hands and get to my receiver.
Yeah, this one in particular, I actually, you know, via the magic of YouTube, watched this on like a quarter playback speed. By the time he was clutched, like, he dropped back and he was out with that ball, and the Ravens defender was already in front of the guy. I mean, he essentially threw it to a Ravens defender. So I guess in that particular scenario, my point is moot, but it's like they knew exactly where to be with the ball, like exactly where he was going with the ball. And you're right. I mean, Matt Stafford didn't for one second be like, and just sort of like pull it.
Yeah, and it was an excellent performance by the Ravens defense overall. I mean, it's tough to go into this game. You're playing the Rams. You don't have Lamar Jackson, and it's been kind of a frustrating, you know, final stretch of the season for the Ravens to not have Jackson. So they kept them in the game. They had a chance to win it. It just, you know, there were a couple plays at the end of the game that the Rams made, and, you know, involved some of the new acquisitions, right? You have the clutch fourth down conversion and the touchdown to Odell, and then you have the sack by Von Miller that essentially sealed the game for the Rams. So they are getting some of what they hoped from the players they brought in. But yeah, I don't think the ceiling for the Rams is any lower than we thought it was. But, you know, you see some of these plays and some of these performances come up these last few weeks, and you're just kind of not sure if they'll be able to achieve their ceiling.
I want to make two more quick points about this Rams team before we move on, and then we'll be done with it for now. Number one, Odell Beckham Jr., obviously not a big statistical day, 5 catches, 39 yards. He did have the game-winning touchdown, but he also made a 4th-and-4 catch to keep the final drive alive. That was just incredible hands on that. I mean, you know, Stafford is whipping at 100 miles an hour. He had a defender hanging off of him, and he just ends up securing it and keeping that drive going. But the other thing I want to mention here is Jenny, you brought this up last week, 2 weeks ago, perhaps a few times this season. You know, this is a team, we saw what the 49ers did to them. Big physical run games give them issues. And, you know, Aaron Donald and Von Miller are going to dominate in the pass rush. But, you know, Baltimore ends up running for 165 in this game. And that seems like at some point in the postseason, it's going to be an issue.
And next week, they have their nemesis, the 49ers.
Raiders, Colts.
All right, so the Rich Bisaccia Raiders still alive here. Kind of a weird week as far as preparation for this game went. Carson Wentz, it looked like he was going to be out, and then he ends up getting out of COVID-19 reserve protocols in time to start in this game. He did not play well. The Raiders also, this is the second straight week the Raiders have lost the turnover battle minus two and still gone out and won the game. Last week it was Drew Lock and the Broncos at home. Maybe not that impressive, but this week, this is a really good Colts team. And they went in there, and they battled back, and they're still somehow still alive here.
So one quick note about Wentz's availability. The way that it was reported pregame, the NFL Network said that his symptoms were lessening. The way the CDC described the five-day return period was that if you were asymptomatic. So symptoms lessening is different from asymptomatic. Also, the CDC, health officials seem to have indicated today that maybe a negative test would be a good idea. And at the end of that 5-day period, and you can understand like the testing availability in our country is not what it should be, which is a whole other discussion, but the NFL has a lot of testing availability. So it seems like that is a very realistic and reasonable additional step to include, especially given that you can't wear a mask the whole time. I mean, like, if you're making this return under the CDC guidelines, you're supposed to wear the mask for the final 5 days. And it's not possible if you're at practice or in the game to be wearing the mask in those situations. So it just seems like maybe in that case, a test on the back end would be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I would always 100% rather know that I have a virus than not to know that I have a virus. And, you know, that's kind of been the way that I've lived my life up until this point. So I don't know. I think it's always good when people know that they're sick. But yeah, it's just, I mean, we talked about this. It's just a weird way to solve a problem, right? We don't want to know if these guys are positive, and that just seems to be kind of their whole deal at this point. But I don't know. I want to talk about Hunter Renfrow. Can we talk about Hunter Renfrow?
Yeah. Go for it, Connor.
He's really good. I don't know. Like, I think it's weird. Like, once they lost, once Henry Ruggs is no longer a part of the team, I think they lost some of the interplay with a lot of the deep routes that set up these sort of Derek Carr deep shots that seem to be sort of part and parcel of the regular season. But this mid-range game that they have now with Renfrow is, I mean, they're moving the ball. They're moving the ball really well. And I think he's a huge part of that. This is another player that, like, when John Gruden drafted him, I was like, okay, he's just drafting him because it's the guy who made the catch from the Clemson thing, and John Gruden is just a ridiculous Madden person cosplaying as a head coach. But again, I mean, it wasn't a bad thing. Like, who knew Sunday, January 2nd, that I would be kind of coming around full circle to John Gruden, the personnel man at this point. I don't know.
Wow.
I can't believe you're saying Gruden was right all along.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Not about any of...
I was going to say.
Only
on Hunter Renfrow. This narrow topic.
Yeah, nothing related to anything on his computer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Hunter Renfrow is really good, and Zay Jones has stepped up. Because they're without Darren Waller, too, who really is the centerpiece of this passing game. So they're doing it without him. It really is amazing. They're just hanging out. They're hanging in every week. And even 2 weeks ago when they beat the Nick Mullins Browns on that was a Wednesday morning or whenever they played, I mean, it just seemed like, okay, well, this team's going to, you know, whatever. They'll be done soon. They're just not going to be good enough, but they just hang around every week.
How do you, at this point, it was reported this morning that the Raiders have not put in any slips yet to interview prospective head coaches, whereas the Jaguars have already conducted at least one with Doug Peterson. But how do you take the job away from Rich Bisaccia now? Like, if he makes the playoffs, how do you, in these circumstances, and I know, I like, trust me, I mean, the history of interns taking over is terrible. It's not good. You know, we've seen this time and time again where it's that, like, very short honeymoon period, and then eventually, you know, everything sort of evens itself out. But if you're Mark Davis, how do you tell all these guys that this guy isn't going to be your head coach anymore? I mean, he's steered them through arguably one of the most chaotic periods that an interim coach has ever had to come across.
Yeah, it's a great question, Connor. And I think the scenario set up that if the Colts win in week 18, the Raiders-Chargers game is a whoever wins that game gets in. And that's a pretty impressive place for this Raiders team to be at this juncture and with everything that has happened this season. So maybe they haven't put in the slips out of respect to what Bisaccia has done, even if they do intend to look around. But also, maybe you're right. Like, maybe they want to give him serious consideration.
Or maybe they're secretly just waiting for Jim Harbaugh.
It's just, oh man, that's probably the most likely scenario. But you just, I feel like the last time we went through this with like the interim coach and there's all this like really like good energy was the Freddie Kitchens thing. So
right,
we'll see how it plays out. But it is like, I don't know. It's exceptional what's happened there. Obviously, it's a team that's rallied. I hate to paint it as like, oh, what a feel good story. Like all this really horrible stuff that people who used to be part of this organization have done this year that have landed them in this really weird spot. But you know, it's just whatever's happened with that locker room, they stayed together, and the fact that, you know, Jenny said it, the fact that they're in it is just you don't want to give out participation trophies here, but it's just really impressive.
Yeah, and I don't like that framing either, Gary, though what I will say is the players and the coaches that are still in the locker room had nothing to do with any of that,
yeah.
Right? So for them, this is a situation they didn't expect themselves to be in. And, you know, that's a lot of bad stuff going on around you. So I do think there is some, you know, respect for what those people who are currently there have done.
Dolphins, Titans.
So, boy, you just kind of wondered what was going to happen with this Dolphins team once the schedule got back to sort of, I don't know, it felt like, you know, a college basketball schedule where it's like you played all your sort of out-of-conference opponents and you got to pick on Ian Book and all that stuff for a couple of months, and now, like, the ACC season is here and it's time for the real games to start. But, man, they got handed to them in Nashville here, and it looks like the season is pretty much over, and like every concern you would have about Tua Tagovailoa really showed up in this loss here.
Yeah, this game even broke resident Dolphins enthusiast Rohan Nadkarni, who was pretty resigned and had his most rooted in facts takes about the Dolphins, I would say, at this juncture after this game.
Yeah, poor Rohan. I mean, you hate to see Tua do this to him. You know, I honestly thought that Gary would have put this higher in the pod schedule so as to sort of make this a long con to almost end the season on a positive Jacoby Brissett take. I was actually surprised that this wasn't sort of waiting in the wings here. But yeah, it's weird, right? It's I think any team with athletic enough safeties and some linebackers who can drop are going to defend this team well enough, and that's really ultimately the problem. I think Brian Flores went a long way towards, you know, saving his job, saving sort of the current state of the franchise. I mean, I think that the Dolphins are still could be considered an ascending team, but there's no doubt that they have to kind of either get a new offensive coordinator or get in the mix for a different player back there, because it's not working. They're not going to be able to, as you said, Gary, play Ian Book every week, which poor Ian Book, by the way.
it was a rough debut for Ian Book last Monday night. We didn't get to cover it on the show, and you know what? We probably won't cover Ian Book again this season.
On the flip side, though, a pretty good day for the Titans, who, with the Chiefs' loss, they are now in position to potentially secure a first-round playoff bye, which would be huge for the potential return of Derrick Henry. And I don't know, you kind of have to be impressed with how the Titans have built their team. I mean, they didn't go all in on spend a ton on a quarterback. They went and got Ryan Tannehill, and they said, okay, we can win with Ryan Tannehill, and we're going to build this team a slightly different way. And they've been really successful.
I mean, it's amazing. They have the best, arguably one of the three or four best defensive players in the league. And let me just hit the Google machine real quick. I think Kevin Byard is, what, a third-round pick, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I'm going to say yes.
Third-round pick, yeah. 64th overall from Middle Tennessee State. And so I went through this, actually, a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it really is incredible, right? Like, to Jenny's point, right, Ryan Tannehill is your quarterback, but also, like, your best defensive player is a third-round pick out of Middle Tennessee State. Another one of your best defensive players is a fourth-round pick out of Iowa, Monty Hooker. You know, Jeffrey Simmons, who is, you know, this is a big pro Jeffrey Simmons pod. You know, we obviously love Jeffrey Simmons, but they seem to just, you know, A.J. Brown was a second-round pick. Like, they seem to be doing some just really smart things. I mean, there are some teams that just have that direct field-to-scout pipeline where you can plug people in and it makes sense in the system and everybody's kind of on the same page. And you see those teams consistently at the top of the division.
Yeah, and it's, you know, bucked the narrative that people from the Belichick Patriots tree can't go elsewhere, although Vrabel developed as a coach kind of on his own, and perhaps he took different things from being a player in the system with the Patriots versus an assistant coach.
Texans 49ers.
All right, so Trey Lance gets start number two. He gets win number one as a starter, and that's all good news there. This one was a little bit closer than the 23-7 final score would indicate. The Texans did lead in the second half in this one, but the Trey Lance thing, and I'm really excited for Trey Lance in the long run still, but it's just not there this year.
It's funny, Gary. I like when we address similar topics on the website and have not polar opposite takes, but different enough takes. And I think what was interesting was going back and watching his first start of the year, there was, to your point, a lot of sort of bad read option stuff, just kind of unoriginal stuff, which takes the offensive line out of the rhythm. But some of his longest passing plays were the vintage Shanahanian, you know, you establish that deep threat early in the game, and then you allow him to take deep defenders, and then you slice that second receiver underneath, you know, that space where mm-hmm. you draw the zone defenders up, and then the other guys fade back. And he was completing those balls with regularity. You know, the timing was right on those, and I was like, well, why aren't they just doing that all the time? I mean, that is essentially the essence of the Kyle Shanahan offense. Like, if you had to boil it down to one play, like, that's the play. So I was wondering, like, and I thought you made a good point, but it's like, why? I think he can do a lot of the things that you want him to do, so why aren't you doing it? And I think that this was still a little bit of a mishmash, or at least too much of a mishmash for my liking.
Yeah, you had high anticipation for this game, Connor, so I was eager to hear your assessment.
Well, Jenny, like a lot of things, I don't know if this is a good thing for somebody who writes on a professional sports website, but I think that any time that I write something, people should just say, I don't know. Like, they should just, you know, or they should just say, maybe we should calm down a little bit. I think I'm too excitable. If this season taught me anything, it's that, my general zest for things that I get excited about, it's just, you know, there needs to be an internal mechanism to sort of pump the brakes on that.
No, but I think there was a lot of anticipation for this game, and I think there's a lot to build on there. And they told us, right, the 49ers said that this wasn't going to be Trey Lance's year. They wanted him to develop. But I think because there were some early flashes in training camp, everyone got really excited and were like, oh, wait, this is going to happen soon. Like, this is going to happen sooner than we thought. But we need to go back to, like, what the initial assessment was at drafting and just be patient. I think 2022 could be a really good year, Connor.
Here's two like weird concerns that I, well, one weird concern is that he doesn't particularly pick up short yardage runs necessarily very well. Like he got stopped on like a third and like stonewalled on like a third and two at some point in this game. And, you know, that happened in the Cardinals game too, where he was like, they brought him out for like a fourth and short and he got stonewalled. Now the following play call in the Texans game was atrocious. It was like an option pitch back that took the running back like 10 yards behind the line of scrimmage and didn't get it. But like I part of the promise of this was that Trey Lance was going to be like plus plus in the inside run game. And then all of a sudden, like everything sort of transforms off the back of that. And I feel like while his mobility has been good, it's not quite what I expected. I guess I didn't listen to anyone's professional assessment of him and just sort of imagined how
you wanted it to be, but that's okay too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think it's one of those things where you watch, you know, you watch like North Dakota State and you're just like, God, can you imagine if that guy just started running up the middle? You'd destroy people. And scouts are like, no, that's not what he does. And then it's like, yeah, no, he does. That's what he's going to do. And so, yeah, no, again, I think the theme of 2021, you know, my New Year's resolution is going to be to listen to other people who know more than me.
That's fine, but there was no problem with your Trey Lance take. And I will say, as far as that run game goes, it does remind me, it's different stylistically, but it does remind me a little bit of Kyler Murray as a rookie, where, I mean, if you go back and watch, there were a lot of times where he thought he was going to run around the edge and outrun someone to the perimeter, and it's like, no, those guys are a lot faster than they are in the Big 12, and they were just chasing him down, and it took him a season to adjust to that, and I think you're going to see, you know, Trey Lance, it'll take a little bit of time to get used to that kind of stuff. I was encouraged by the fact that it did look like a Shanahan offense this week, unlike the Arizona game. I was not encouraged by the number of times, and again, it's impossible to say with absolute certainty at this point before you see the All-22 and see exactly what was happening downfield, but there were just too many times where it looked like he was taking the play out of structure and sort of forcing the second reaction stuff. It got better as the game went on, but it didn't get better to a point where you'd say, okay, this thing's ready to go forward with now. Like, I still think, in my mind, there's no doubt they have to go back to Garoppolo as soon as Garoppolo is healthy. And if they don't, it's probably going to end poorly, although it also might end poorly because they're still starting like Josh Norman at cornerback in 2022, so...
Can I just you brought up Game Pass, so I feel contractually obligated to mention that Game Pass is terrible, and and that I was watching the Cardinals game for the piece that I wrote last week, and I could not. Game Pass was so bad that I could not identify a tight end on a play. Like, no matter how many times I spent 40 minutes of my life trying to stop the screen in enough time to just see what tight end it was. And I could not get clear enough resolution on at any moment and at any angle. And it's just, it is the worst product on earth. I think it's on purpose. I think that coaches knew that there were smart people like Gary and Jenny who had access to All 22 film and they wanted to shut it down. And I'm not going to stop until I'm forcibly silenced on the matter.
Well, you probably just didn't realize that Game Pass now has the default tight end filter on. It just takes all tight ends. So if you watch Bears game tape, there's just like four guys on the field, and that's it.
It does to tight ends what happened to Joe Burrow's name on the back of its jersey. It just wipes them right off.
See, we all had one-liners for that one.
Boom.
Eagles, Washington.
All right, so this one was a lot more interesting than the last time these teams met, and the Eagles just sort of ran all over Washington here. It was a competitive game. Eagles had to come back, but they end up pulling out another win. And this is a team that, again, boy, they flipped the switch on something midseason, and they are a legitimate playoff team at this point. They're sitting at 9-7.
Really cool. I think that... it's unique. I think, and what sets Philadelphia apart from other teams right now is, and this was really interesting, like to go back to the Doug Peterson years and look at how a similar version of this offensive line was utilized. And I think the new staff came in and said, wow, like, you know, this offensive line can maul people. Like they can really knock people over. And Philadelphia came into the game as the number one rushing offense in the NFL. And what they're doing is really interesting. They're kind of blending the Ravens flavor, right? You know, they want the backfield misdirection. They want the zone read. But then also they can just, you know, shift gears, throw it in 13 personnel and run like a big heavy offense that just jams the ball down your throat. And I think that makes them sort of dualistic in a way that a lot of these teams aren't. And then driving that engine is Jalen Hurts, who's just been fabulous this year.
Yeah, I mean, they figured out a system and a scheme that worked with Hurts. They went into the season not sure that Hurts would be the guy, but give Nick Sirianni and his staff credit that they said, we're going to give Hurts every opportunity to show that he could be the guy. And maybe you come out of this season and you're not necessarily in the quarterback market. I mean, that's how well he's played. And I think it's impressive that they started off the year the way they did and they were able to figure some things out. And we did not think that they would be a playoff team this year. And they are sitting in a position where they are very likely going to be a playoff team.
Can I play a bad talk radio game with you guys?
Oh, always.
All right. Uh-oh. I have to do my voice. So like, okay, Jenny and Gary, say that Russell Wilson, I'm not going to do that. So Russell Wilson narrows his list down and, you know, Philadelphia is the team. Like, he's like, I want to come here. I have a passion for the city of Philadelphia and I'm eventually going to buy part of the Eagles, whatever it is, 3 first round picks. And you have the ammo, right? You have you have all 3 of them this year, right? You have everything ready to give to them. It's not going to cost you a ton in like future capital. You're just basically sacrificing this year. Do you do the deal for Russell Wilson, or do you say like, no, we got our guy?
I do it. And I am slightly hesitant because I do wonder if Russell Wilson is going. Look, he hasn't played well this season. He played well. We'll get to it in the lightning-ish round. He really, really ate up the lines today. But I wonder if maybe this is the start of his decline that we're seeing right now. But yeah, I think I'd pull the trigger on that.
I probably would too, and I'm the person that just said maybe you're not in the quarterback market, but I think you're not like in the quarterback market where you're desperate to get anybody. You're only in the quarterback market if you can get a handful of guys that you feel like are at that next level, like a Russell Wilson or an Aaron Rodgers. But other than that, I mean, Hurts has been excellent this year and has exceeded expectations. So at least it gives you some flexibility that you don't have to get somebody this year.
Yeah, this is good. I'm going to now sort of just bundle this in a tweet and say Jenny Vrentis and Gary Gramling said to trade Jalen Hurts for Russell Wilson.
Oh, man.
So that'll be perfect. Thank you guys for that.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter is the place for no nuance, so that would be good.
Broncos, Chargers.
So, I don't know. Look, we all had sort of jangled nerves when it came to the Chargers. That's what happens when you go down to Houston and get sort of run over like they did. But this seemed like a game that might get a little bit hairy here for them. It's a division rival. It's a Vic Fangio defense. It's a team that really wants to establish a physical run game. And as we know, all these Los Angeles teams, so soft against the run. But no, the Chargers just went out and just clocked the Broncos in this one. And I don't want to overstate what they did defensively because, look, Drew Lock is limited. It's just not going to work out for him in Denver. But it was just a really impressive performance on both sides of the ball. And on top of that, they also got a kickoff return touchdown. So they did it all today in a really, just no drama win for them.
It was stunning, though, Gary, to your point, like going into this week, how with a team with this personnel, like how many first round picks, second round picks you have invested in your front 7 defensively, and how you could so regularly be blown off the line of scrimmage. Like I'd not seen something like that. And especially a Brandon Staley defense, which is essentially a Vic Fangio defense. And you were saying, you know, this is what the Chargers bought. Like, that's what you purchased, was a stout run defense, essentially, like a team that could handle these sort of situations. And then you get sliced up by Rex Burkhead. So coming into this, you think, you know, Javonte Williams, you know, you think about all the stuff that could possibly go wrong. You're thinking, I don't like this matchup at all. And it's so weird. Like, it's been a Staley coaster. I think you guys know. I mean, you remember from the first, you know, couple episodes, Dave Gettleman, it was full bloom love. I mean, couldn't get the guy out of my head. And now all of a sudden it's like, you know, now we're just sort of riding the wave a little bit, you know?
Connor, I know it's been a few rough Sundays for you where you didn't have the Brandon Staley post-game locker room video. I know that that has made it difficult to forge ahead on each of the weeks that the Chargers lost a game. So I'm glad that you have that. But going into next week, like, I'm not so sure. Like, there are points in the season where I thought the Chargers are a team you definitely don't want to see because they can just, you know, do what they want on offense. And, you know, Justin Herbert has had, you know, amazing plays this season. Like, when you have a quarterback like that, you don't want to face them. But might be a tight matchup with the Raiders next week. Like, I'm not sure who I'm going to pick in that one. And I think, you know, maybe both LA teams have been hard to figure, but certainly the Chargers. It's been a little bit of a riddle this season. And also, I will say that last week's loss came at the hands of Connor's Coach of the Year candidate, David Culley, so maybe it wasn't as bad of a loss as Gary presented it. I just wanted to throw that out there.
You had coaches 1-2, and, you know, that's the way it goes there. This was a nice bounce back for Brandon Staley, though. This was a sign of a good coach getting that team ready to go
right
for this one.
Right, that is true. It was a good bounce back game against the Broncos team that was probably farther out of the mix than their record indicated at most points this season.
Yeah, and I think it probably, you know, and you don't want to speculate on anything, you know, too much, but I think this probably almost locks up an opening in Denver, and to me, probably one of the most or more or most sought-after jobs, I think. I mean, it's going to be a limited opening slate of openings this year, but I think that there's going to be a line out the door for that Broncos job. I think a lot of people are going to want that.
And maybe you see a little bit of a role reversal here, and maybe Vic Fangio goes with his old mentee in LA and tries to fix the defense a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Panthers, Saints.
So this game was a little bit difficult to watch, but also just too close to look away at any point. A lot of field goals. Not a whole lot of offense. And I guess that's the identity of these two teams at this point. Taysom Hill was back under center for the Saints in this one, doing his sort of dual threat thing. They can't quite get Alvin Kamara going until the very end of the game. And as far as the Panthers go, Sam Darnold back out there, and it's just, it's just not going to work.
I honestly thought that the Panthers and Saints played like four times this year, to the point where my Game Pass froze on the Panthers and Saints. Like, I left the room and I came back and the Panthers and Saints were on, and I was like, oh, this is broken. This must have been paused from like 3 weeks ago. And I like restarted, not Game Pass, Red Zone. I restarted Red Zone because I thought that the Panthers and Saints had already played each other. Like, this game was just... It like had zero register in terms of watchability or attractiveness to me. And the only, you know, I guess the only main takeaway here is like Sam Darnold, like if you're trying to evaluate the decision making of the Matt Rhule regime, it's like how much less good does Sam Darnold look with a different offensive coordinator than he looked at the beginning of the season with Joe Brady, who at least kind of got him on the move. And you know Sam Darnold, I think, is best on the run, and it's just, you know, there was nothing there for him in the game plan.
Yeah, I went on Twitter after this game and I saw that like Matt Rhule was trending, and I didn't know why, and I clicked and it was just like a bunch of Panthers fans all tweeting Fire Rhule or some version of that hashtag. I mean, clearly the fan base is restless, and David Tepper is in a difficult position here because he gave Matt Rhule, who had never been an NFL head coach before, a 7-year contract when they hired him. They wanted him so badly that they gave him a 7-year contract. So, the expectation, it sounds like he'll be back for his third year, but it's certainly been a mediocre first 2 years. And there hasn't been, yes, like they haven't had the quarterback that they want. They haven't found their franchise quarterback. But I think the point you made, Connor, is exactly right. Even without that, you can evaluate some of the other decisions being made. And are those decisions getting you closer to where you want to go? And I would say that no, there hasn't been a lot of indications of that so far.
Right. Like, you know, the other thing, like one of the excuses, not excuses, but one of the things that I think, was it Rule or was it Tepper? I'm not sure. Or it might have been one of the league insiders that was reporting that Rule was safe and then just giving the excuse anonymously. But some said, well, they didn't have Christian McCaffrey for a lot of this year. If your best player is a running back, you're not going to have him for a lot of years because running backs get hurt all the time and you have to come up with a different plan. Like, to Jetty's point, look at how good the Titans are and they don't have Derrick Henry. It doesn't matter. They can succeed without. And so it's like, you know, if your team is not built similarly because they don't run the same offense, but like, okay, your best player is Christian McCaffrey and he's not in. Too bad. You know, I don't feel bad for you because you built the team or you continued to build the team in a way that accentuates the running back as the focal point of the offense. And as Matt Rhule, you came in and had the authority to change that, and you chose not to.
So before we get to the lightning round here, because I will not relegate this development to that period of the show, but somehow we're in like hour two of the show, and we're just getting to the most important announcement. I'll give you the bad news, and then I'll give you the not as bad news. This is going to be Jenny's last show as an official co-host on the MMQB podcast. She is, as many of you might know, she has a passion for hyper-local news, and she is joining the local paper in New York City, and she's gonna work in the New York Times now, doing enterprise and investigative reporting on a national basis. It's not gonna be just the local stuff. She will be back on the show. We will make her come back. We will argue with the Times if they try and block this in any way, shape, or form. We will be nice at first, and then we will threaten them if it's going to be a problem. But I guess you'll hear from her less often, and she won't say her name at the very top of the show anymore. But I don't know. I wanted to let everyone know that, and I wanted to give Connor and I a chance to say very nice things about Jenny, which we will also say in person. But this is the public statements now. So, Connor, would you like to take it away?
Oh, boy. I mean, Jenny has been the most important, and I mean, and anyone who listens to the Weak Side podcast, I've said this before. I say this to random strangers. I've said this to my parents. I've said this to my wife. I mean, Jenny's been the most influential person in my working life, and you know, I first talked to Jenny on the phone as an intern at the Star Ledger, and she was down in Dallas covering the owners' meetings, and I was trying not to screw up, and she was really cool. And then we ended up working together on the Jets beat, and you know, she taught me so many things about everything, but mostly I think to treat everybody with respect and humility, and just, you know, watching her, being able to watch her work was like a graduate education that I never got. And I just, you know, I remember our first combine together, us talking about our goals and what we had hoped was going to happen in the future. And she had said that one day she hoped to work at Sports Illustrated. That was my dream too. And it's just been a dream come true. I mean, you know, I consider myself the luckiest person in the world to have worked with Jenny for as long as I have. And, yeah, I mean, there's no one more important to my career. I owe Jenny everything, and I'm going to miss her a lot. And I mean, yeah, we're just going to call her at all hours of the day. Like, you know, if we're recording a podcast on Wednesday, you know, we're not even going to tell her, and we're just going to say, hey, like, you have to come on now, because we're going to miss her. And you know, just everything that she's done for us. I mean, you know, her reporting has kept this magazine on the map. Her aggression, her heart, her soul. Like, you know, I think that it's really cool that you know, we can say that we worked on a staff with Jenny, because I think, you know, when we're all old, it's going to be like saying that, it's going to be like saying that, that we got to like, you know, like we got to play backup to like Mick Jagger or something like that, you know, in like a sports writing sense. And so I don't know, that's a very long and rambling way of saying that, you know, we love Jenny more than anything in the world. We're going to miss her dearly. And I just can't, you know, as sad as today is, you know, you just think back to all the days where like you got to wake up and you got to say like, my job today is to record a podcast with one of my best friends. And my mentor and, you know, moral compass, whatever whatever you want to call it. So that would be my long and rambling way of saying you're loved, you're going to be missed. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if Gary's just going to be able to stand it with a two-person thing. Like, you know, we're going to just call you all the time. That's all I got to say.
Well, that's good that you're calling me all the time. I would expect nothing less. I was hoping Gary would just kind of cram this in at the end, right before the end credits. I don't like talking about myself, but that was very, very sweet and kind and means a lot. And now I'm emotional and wiping my eyes with the towel that I use when I work out. So I have a sweaty towel all over my face. But thank you, I mean, for saying all of those wonderful things. It has been, you know, one of the highlights of my 8 years has been doing the podcast with you two and Shelby, our amazing producer. This is an awesome team. And it was something I really looked forward to during the pandemic when we were all isolated and I was living alone. You know, we had the weekly podcast. Wow, this is embarrassing. Shelby, you're going to need to beep this out.
No, you're doing great. You're doing great.
You know Shelby will clean this up.
I don't know. Maybe he'll keep it in. Shelby does do an excellent job of editing every week, so I'm trusting you right now. But thank you. Thank you both. Thank you all. Both is two. All is three. So that was a... but... yeah. Really sad to leave. And it's because of the great people at SI. So the three of you are among the very best here.
Jenny and I still have plans to look at restaurant space and create a vegan-inspired taco restaurant. So fear not, we will be back in just
That's
a different
right.
way.
That's right. Know? That's right. Just, so we'll have our restaurant opening to look forward to as our next shared career stop, Connor.
Lions, Seahawks.
Great. Well, this will sober us up. I mean, this is excellent. There was a football game played.
Yeah. I will just say, as a special gift to Jenny, we have 250 point games in the Lightning's round.
It's just excellent.
We should have gotten you something better for going away, but this is what we're getting you instead.
I mean, a 50 point game is hard to come by.
It was, and you know what? This might have been Russell Wilson's last game in Seattle, and this was a nice performance, even if, like, I don't know, beating Tim Boyle Lions is not really the way we all imagine going out in a blaze of glory.
Maybe I'll see Russell Wilson at New York Times orientation this week. Maybe he also has a next step in mind, so.
He's the new op-ed columnist.
Yeah, there you go. You never know. I'll let you guys know if we see him on the Zoom.
Did it feel a little bit like a come get me performance? You know what I mean? Like a sort of a wink, wink, like this is what I can do on a regular basis kind of performance. I would say, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't think he's that kind of maniacal and plotting. I certainly like the talk of the decline, I think, is, you know, to Gary's point, I do think that there was some evidence of some stuff, some of the Russell Wilsonian things that he does regularly that we haven't seen in the repertoire. But to me, the hand just seems so bothersome, and it has not been the same since he came back from that. I do think with a full off season there, I think he should probably be okay. And to your point, I would if I were the Eagles, I would trade for him too.
Falcons, Bills.
With a little bit of a dusting on the ground, the Bills beat the Falcons out in Western New York, and I don't know. There's not a ton to talk about from this game, which unfolded fairly predictably, outside of maybe the early safety that the Falcons scored. But I don't know. Matt Ryan did a weird thing. Matt Ryan had the nightmare scenario, as far as I'm concerned. If I were an NFL player. He thought he scored a touchdown and picked up a taunting flag for it, but then it turned out they reviewed it and they put him like just outside the goal line, but because the taunting flag still stands, they back him all the way up to the 15 and a couple of inches, and that's just awful.
Yeah, but do you think that he was actually taunting, or do you think he was having a word with the player because of how he played it?
Matt Ryan doesn't strike me as a taunter. He strikes me as a having a word kind of person.
Yeah, you know? Like that one didn't come across to me like, I mean, there's been much debate about the taunting penalties all season. So, I mean, this has been discussed ad infinitum. But that one to me was just kind of weird. Like, it just seemed like he was frustrated with the player and said something rather than taunting him.
But if you're Matt Ryan, do you then just weaponize that as your built-in excuse? And anytime you taunt someone, you just say, well, I'm Matt Ryan. I'm just having a word with him.
Yeah.
I'm not.
What I is guess the... that's...
that's a show we're going to do on Wednesday, by the way.
So weird thing from this game. Because of the snow, some of the Fox graphics, like the graphic on field that told you what down and distance it was, mm-hmm. like I think it backed up against the snow funny, and so it was the same color as the Bills players' jerseys. So mm-hmm. at like and they were like on the outside of the hashes. So like during like routes, like Cole Beasley would like partially disappear for portions of the route, and I just didn't like that. I was worried about Cole Beasley, you know. I just wanted to make sure that he was there, you know.
Well, with your experience with tight ends disappearing off the screen, so, you know, I could see why. But yeah, just to clarify, like I don't think anything dirty was done on that play, but Matt Ryan crosses the goal line, and because Jordan Poyer is already running that way, right, he kind of tumbles over him. And, you know, again, you can't really control that. You're running at each other, and there wasn't, like, any head contact or anything. But, like, I don't know. Maybe he said something like, why are you diving at me? I already made it across the goal line, which I guess in retrospect sounds a little bit like a taunt. So maybe I should retract my previous take.
That's where we landed after this debate among the jurors.
Yeah, great. Really going out on a high note here, guys.
It's going to be funny when Gary and I, like, it'll be like the ultimate sad podcast and everyone will know we're really reeling. Like, I'll make Gary do an entire show on the Falcons post Jenny.
Oh,
and it'll just
God.
Be the two of, and it'll no. just be the two of us being like, we miss Jenny and we hate the Falcons and man. And then it'll just fall apart from there, you know?
Jaguars, Patriots.
So I don't know. There's something really insulting about the score 50-10. It's just too many round numbers. It shouldn't happen. It's unnatural.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just gonna. You know, I think that's a take. You know. I enjoyed this game particularly because of the fact that Mac Jones and Bill Belichick kind of shared a lighthearted moment. Like, first of all, big emotional Mac Jones game, a lot of Mac emotion. I thought I was going to try to put Mac into emotion. Thought I had it there for a second, but not a word combination I could make work. He was Mac-cited. He was very Mac-cited, I guess.
You got it. You got it.
Yeah, I got it. But it was fun to see sort of the juxtaposition of, I guess, in like a big picture sort of thing, like the idea of what Tom Brady had always wanted, this gargantuan star power team crumbling and almost losing to the Jets, and then Bill Belichick and Mac Jones, like buddy, you know, the buddy cop, like young rookie and old gruff sergeant kind of thing they had going on there. It was sort of it was just a cute little thing. I enjoyed it.
I thought it was an important game for Mac Jones. Like, yes, it was against the Jaguars, but, you know, he had two rough weeks. A lot of talk about the rookie wall, the longest season he's ever played. And he had a bounce back game. Gives a little bit of confidence going into the playoffs. And that was also what they did today. They clinched a playoff bid, which, you know, you have to say they had one down year after Tom Brady and they come back and now they're back in the playoffs. Bills will probably win the division, but they're in the playoffs as a wild card team. And, you know, I think it's pretty been pretty impressive year in terms of how they built a roster that could win and how they rebuilt this quickly after the Brady era.
Yeah, you know, it also just makes you pray for Trevor Lawrence. Like, you hope that they find somebody here. I mean, it was like from the first series, it was just free runners. You know, he was just getting demolished. And you just I don't know necessarily. You know, it's interesting. Like, right now, it seems like a lot of the coaches are going to wait until after the season. A lot of the big coordinators are going to wait until after the season. Dan Quinn, Nathaniel Hackett are both postponing their interviews there at Jacksonville. If I were them, I wouldn't care if I was the last person to hire a coach. Like, you cannot screw this up. You cannot do that to this kid again for another year, because you will waste, like, one of the best quarterback prospects in NFL history, and it's going to be a real bummer if that happens.
Giants Bears.
I think this is a fitting one to end on here.
There's so many bad games. I thought this podcast was ending, like, four games ago. I was like, holy crap, there's another one?
It's like, whatever. I had the Twitter going, and our old colleague Kaylin Kaler was apparently at this game, and she's tweeting stuff about it, but in cryptic GIFs and stuff like that. And it was just funny trying to figure out, like, wow, what is she watching? I don't see any of this happening in any of these games, because I don't know. It was pretty clear from the start the Giants weren't particularly interested in winning this game or competing in any way, shape, or form. I just want to – you guys can open it up, because I know Joe Judge said some interesting he said some things after the game. I just want to point out, this is a game that the Giants trailed by 14 points almost immediately. They lost by 26 points. And yet their run-pass ratio in terms of play calls was 39 runs and 16 passes. They had negative 10 passing yards, as well as two interceptions from Mike Glennon. So I just think it's pretty phenomenal to go more than 2-1 run-to-pass in a game that you trailed significantly throughout.
You know what was also remarkable, Gary? The arrogance that Joe Judge displayed in his post-game press conference. That was remarkable. Like, to lose a game like this to a team that hasn't been very good this year, and then to come out and say that this is working, and to say it in a tone that basically, it wasn't even the tone, it was his actual words. Like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You don't see it. As if the product on the field on Sundays doesn't matter at all. Like, he's saying, oh, we're building behind the scenes. Guys who left wish they were still here. Like, you don't even know. But it's like, but we see, like, we do know the product. Like, we can see that the team is not making progress. And, you know, a few weeks ago, it was put out there that Judge would be back in 2022, and it's just hard to see what he's done this season to earn the confidence, other than the organization not wanting yet another, you know, change at the coaching position, because they've been this revolving door of coaches, and that's not what the Giants organization wants to be, but that's what they have been. But just because you made bad mistakes in the past, that shouldn't color how you're assessing the current situation. And I mean, maybe they are seeing something behind the scenes, and maybe that's why Judge is so confident, but the product that's been on the field has been indefensible.
I have been to press conferences at the end of the Ben McAdoo era. I've been to press conferences, I think, at the end of the Pat Shurmur era, and I've been to I went to Giants last week before the game, and I will say it was nothing like Joe Judge walked out to practice to talk to reporters as if he knew with absolute certainty that he was coming back next year and that nothing was going to change that, you know. And I think that I think obviously, you know, having their previous two coaches go two and out colored the owner's decision making there and whatever, but for him to come out and say that, his quote after the game was pretty amazing. And I might actually try this in my life. Is he said, we went into this game saying that we wanted to run the ball a lot. We didn't want them to run the ball a lot. And we wanted to cover kicks well. And we got that accomplished. And like what an amazing, like, that would be like, that would be like Gary assigning me a story and then saying, well, Gary, my goals here, I'm going to use a lot of semicolons. I'm going to capitalize some letters and I'm going to write it in Microsoft Word. And then, but then just not turn anything in, you know? And it's like, you didn't do the whole, like, those three things have to amount to a victory in order for you to say mission accomplished. Like, you can't, you're not allowed to say the one thing without saying the other things.
That's how I'll consult with Mitch. That's not a bad game plan going forward with you, though. Sort of ease you back into this.
Well, I mean, I think the game plan should be like not to just, you know, not to run a lot of it. Just tell me it's online and then and not put it on the internet, you know?
But, yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right, Connor. And I think the problem with that is if you are in this much denial about what your team is not doing and what it takes to win a game, evidently, then how are they going to get better? Like, if you can't have an honest conversation about the things that went wrong this season and you're just saying that, no, everything's great and players who left still want to be here, like, and we did these things that don't amount to a win, like, I just don't see how you get somewhere better from that. I don't see how you make progress from that.
It was almost, it was reminiscent of... do you remember when John Gruden got the job and he said that, well, yeah, here we go. Right.
Yeah.
and he said, I think he was talking to Howie Long, right? He was doing the Fox interview and he said, all these players are texting me because they want to play for the Raiders. Do you remember when he said that? Yeah. And then I emailed the league because I said it was tampering and no one got back to me, but that was tampering.
That's definitely tampering,
by the way.
Good
and
work,
so, yeah,
Connor.
Joe Judge, you're tampering. You can't. He can't talk to other players on other teams, right? You're not allowed to do that.
Well, did he specify that they're on other teams, or is it like just guys who got cut during training camp and now they're looking for work and they wish they were still employed?
I would too. Yeah, I mean, if you fired me from Sports Illustrated tomorrow, Gary, I'd be like, hey, I really wish I was still at Sports Illustrated. That would be amazing. You know,
I hear from Connor all the time. He still wants to be here.
Maybe Hunter Renfro texted him, and maybe that's why he drafted him. I mean, you know, could have been all part of this master plan. Mm-hmm. I will say, if we're going to circle around to Connor hot buttons, I think before we end this episode, we should mention that the Browns were eliminated from the playoffs, which means that they will neither make the Super Bowl nor win the Super Bowl this season.
I know. This is... you know, it's tough for all of, it was a tough game for a lot of my narrative, or a tough week for a lot of my narratives. I will say, the Oracle needs to do better next year.
You still got the food poisoning, Connor.
Yeah. Yeah, I did correctly predict food poisoning. That's true.
All right. So 1 week to go in the regular season. We'll have our midweek show this week. And, sadly for us, Jenny Varentis, That'll be all as an official host. We will have her back soon. But yeah, New York Times is getting the best. Make sure you check her out there. But make sure you keep on listening to this podcast, because we are making her come back at some point.
That's right, Gary. It's not goodbye. It's see you later. That's one prediction that the Oracle is 100% correct on.
The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Varentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody, and our senior podcast producer is Dan Bloom. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.